sorry to interrupt your recreation.
Deadpanites.
But it is time for
Jack Mangan. Record the second episode of the Deadpan Dark Star Data Palooza.
Oh, I don't
wanna
that.
Hey, Vanaman.
Hey, Jack.
All right, it's been ages, right?
Yes.
So, well, I know you know you've got some time constraints, so we should just get right into this bizarre thing that you and a couple of other folk kind of trumpeted the cause of Dark Star and got it to the point where it's now our Deadpan Palooza topic. But so. Tell me, I guess, you know, there's lots to say about this movie, but I'd love to hear, you know, you were really rallying for the cause here. So what, tell me your Dark Star experience.
Well, I mean, I think I didn't sort of watch it at the time. I mean, I'm not that old. I know someone commented on that. But I saw it like in the early 80s. And I mean, I saw it before I saw Hitchhikers. I think that was my first encounter with let's say, not so serious sci-fi, and right. I mean, everything up to that point had been sort of really deadly serious. I think even when I first watched it, it was like deadly serious, and I was torn to me, like I sort of took it very seriously. I didn't really sort of get it. I look at it now and I sort of get the humor, but when I first saw it in the 80s, I didn't think I got it. I sort of treated it like a serious science fiction film. And I mean, I even bought the novelization. And but it, I don't know, it just, there's something like, it's like irreverence. It's just like the whole sort of like, everything's falling to bits, you know, right. within a Dark Star. Because a lot of science fiction films around the time, everything's like clean and sterile and, you know, everybody's like meticulously clean shaven and everything, aren't they? You know, and like these people, like they're just like a mess, and right. like everything's falling to bits and everything, and of course the ending is just like you can't really describe it as a happy ending, can you?
No, although you know it's so. That's the thing. There's so much to talk about. It's so reminiscent of heavy metal, which of course it should be, because Dan O'Bannon, who had a lot to do with this and even starred in the movie as Pinback, you know, he was one of the major forces behind getting the heavy metal film started. Mm. But you know, it's really, it's the most horrible, awful, like wonderful, bizarre, strange B movie ever. You know, I had heard that it was a parody of 2001, and I get that because it's so, you know, dare I say, deadpan. It's so slow moving and dry, and it certainly picked up some elements from 2001, but I think it was more, or at least as much, a parody of Star Trek. You know, and even the older kind of, you know, four or five guys in a rocket, classic sci-fi films. But you're right that they weren't these pristine. I mean, everyone, they were a mess. I mean, I know it was the 70s, but they all looked like, Boiler looked like he should be out back working on his Camaro. I mean,
I'll take your word on that one. They looked sort of, also like they were sort of stoned, really, didn't they? Like a sort of hangover from the 60s. I mean, not so much the long hair. I mean, Boiler had the long hair, but it was just... there's a lot of facial hair, isn't it?
Right. Yeah, I think, like Doolittle had to get back to his gig as lead singer of Thin Lizzy, you know, after the movie. But it was really, you know, of course there's the fascinating aspect of all the people involved. But yeah, I mean, the film as itself. Now, the thing is, this is actually a really beautiful thing about our little deadpan world, is because this is one of the few places where you could kind of comfortably recommend this film. Because, you know, you've got like a 20-minute sequence with a mischievous beach ball alien.
Yes.
Which is just completely, you're kind of watching it going, oh my God, what the hell am I watching?
And especially when he sort of, sorry, you go on.
Well, I was just it reminded really quickly. It reminded me of Attack of the Killer Tomatoes. It reminded me a lot of Attack of the Killer Tomatoes, which is another really intentionally hokey, campy, cheesy 70s film. But they're both very reminiscent, at least to me. But you had a scene in mind with the giant tomato alien.
Yes. I mean, he did went and he did go on, didn't he, to do Alien, and as you can sort of see, like the similarities, especially going around the dark corridors, isn't it? And with this alien sort of messing with him, really. But it's really hard to take it like a Beach Boys seriously, isn't it? Especially when the way it ends with the tranquilizer gun.
And now it's time for tips for your Dark Star viewing party. Tip number one, be sure to have plenty of alcohol or other mind-altering drugs on hand for your guests.
Hello, Deadpan. This is Amy Bowen, a.k.a. the Deadpan Ambassador. No, I'm not dead. My life for the past month and a half has been consumed by a summer job and being involved in Inception fandom over in LiveJournal. Sorry I've been missing, but hi, I'm back to talk about Dark Star, and this is probably going to go over my 2-minute limit, so I'll have to call back. Maybe. Anyway, so I finally got to watching Dark Star today. I'm really sorry I missed the party. I hope this can still be run in the next episode. This was the first movie we've done for a Palooza that actually made me laugh at how bad it was, especially the beginning, where there's this little round thing on top of the ship, and then it starts beeping. My jaw dropped open. Anyway, I'll call back so I can have the full 2 minutes to do my scientific nitpicks. Bye.
Well, as I understand, it was actually originally a student film, and and of course there was some discussion about this on there was some warning, you know, don't watch the special edition because that's only like 68 minutes long, and you know, the director's cut is 83. That's the one I watched, was the 83 minute.
And you think, like, how much could you take out? Well, still sort of. Well, obviously, because I think used here, something said that they take out like several scenes that make the film sort of nonsensical, don't they? So, it's because it's a short enough film as it is, isn't it? You wonder why they took out, like, was it 15 minutes or something?
Yeah, I don't write about that, and I don't know. Yeah, I really don't know what they took out. And I suppose you could argue both ways. You could say, well, you know, it's. No, there's not really much story, so you could take out, you could really almost edit out, you know, 70 minutes and still tell the same story. But
it is a short film, and it said there's not much of a plot, really, is there? I mean, you know, right. Come to the planet, blow up a planet, and things start going wrong, you know, and but
you're right. And it's truly of a different era, and you know, as someone, I really enjoy. Like, I love Mystery Science Theater. I love campy B movies. Of course, I love Army of Darkness. I love, you know, I can appreciate a good B movie. You know, they're, you know, I have my limits. I mean, sometimes it gets to the point where I'm just kind of rolling my eyes. And there were times during Dark Star when I was just rolling my eyes. But overall, I'm really, you know, that's also another thing about Dark Star. I guess I really was kind of had these moments where I was going, what the hell am I watching? But then. The truly funny moments really catch you off guard and really, you know, really are really excellent. They're really wonderful. I think when Pinback is kind of doing the video diary, I mean, that's just it's so unexpectedly hilarious.
Yeah. Bill Frug. I mean, even the name's a bit funny, isn't it? Bill Frug. Right. Yeah. I mean, I know there was some discussion whether, like, is he sort of insane or is he really, like, not Pinback? And, I mean, I don't think you can analyze the plot too much because the plot starts, like, it just doesn't really sort of make sense, does it, really? If you start thinking about it, like, from a sort of science fiction point of view, like, you know, I mean, there was even something, the ship sort of, it seems like dingy in small corridors, but then you've got this big lift sequence going through all these levels, which seems to be a sort of bit of odds with this. But anyway, that's just me getting diverted a bit, but,
Right.
Yeah, sorry.
No, I know what you mean though. And also, you're right. This is before, you're right. Science fiction back then, everything was so pristine. And that was one of the things I think. I know Star Wars wasn't the first, and obviously it wasn't because Dark Star was before that. But that was one of the great things, one of the truly endearing things about Star Wars was just how beat up everything looked. And
Tip number two. Consider silencing the volume from the movie and instead play Pink Floyd's The Wall throughout the motion picture and notice how well the musical cues match up to the action in the film.
Hey, this is Used Hair calling in my comments for Dark Star. I really, really like this movie. Maybe not so much because it was a really good movie, but because it was from an era when I was really, really getting into sci-fi. In high school and before, I mean, I always enjoyed science fiction, but I didn't really become a sci-fi fan until I hit college and met up with a group of people who could turn me on to the really odd and quirky stuff that went beyond, the Schleck-like Ghostbusters that I really liked, but everybody in the world had seen. So this was one of those films that I had seen that I knew a lot of other people hadn't seen and made me feel better. And so I really enjoyed this movie. And I was kind of, curious to see what would happen this time around because I'm about to watch this movie that I've seen four or five times before. And, well, really, am I going to be able to pick up on anything that I can actually comment on? And sure enough, I did because, oddly enough, despite having seen it a number of times before, this is the first time I actually really looked at the credits and noticed, oh, hey, Pinback is Dan O'Bannon. Oh, hey, look, the special effects are by Dan O'Bannon. Oh, look, it was written by Dan O'Bannon. Oh, look, who the hell is this Dan O'Bannon guy? And I had to really go and start checking it out and was quite surprised to see what this guy had done. I only knew this as John Carpenter's student film. I didn't realize that Dan O'Bannon had gone on to do just as much great stuff. So then actually went out and watched Return of the Living Dead and watched the commentary with him just so I could sit there and watch Pinback give commentary on a movie that was kind of fun.
And of course, again, there's connection here. I believe it was Dan O'Bannon again. Dan O'Bannon was a screenwriter and he was heavily involved. He was everything in this movie. He was probably arguably the star character, although, Doolittle maybe is the star. I don't know. He was one of the lead characters, and
yeah,
and he I believe, I mean, I might be saying this wrong. No, he did some. Well, he didn't do the model effects. Actually, I'm looking at if Wikipedia is to be trusted.
Yes, which, it's your friend, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not not so much. But Dan O'Bannon, obviously, his main claim to fame, of course, is Alien. But he's also, as I mentioned, he did heavy metal, but also Star Wars.
And now it's time for Scientific Nitpicks with Amy Bowen, the part of the show where Amy Bowen comes out and gives scientific nitpicks. Today, scientific nitpicks are about the movie Dark Star. I pressed pause about 1 minute into the movie when they said, "We gather from the 10-year delay that you're approximately 18 parsecs away." So I ran for my computer and, no. Google says 1 parsec equals about 3.26 light years. Assuming these are radio transmissions or something that travels at the speed of light, that would put them 32.6 parsecs away. At least they were aware that parsecs are units of distance. And then from later in that initial transmission, wait, what? Who decided to send them out there without radiation shielding in the first place? Even I know that an atmosphere is a radiation shield, so outside of an atmosphere, you need a radiation shield. And then, later on, somebody says, 99% plus probability is that the planet will deviate from her normal orbit in another 12,000 rotations. It'll spiral in toward the sun, eventual supernova. Supernovae do not work that way. These scientific nitpicks have been brought to you courtesy of the 365 Days of Astronomy podcast, which is how I know a lot of this stuff. Okay, that's it. Bye-bye.
The movie itself, I mean, you know, there's not much to add other than what other people have already said about it. But the one thing that I was really sort of disappointed with this particular version of it, is the box that it comes in. I mean, I'm really excited that the cover art is by Thomas Warkentin, who did, you know, Heavy Metal magazine, and Dan O'Bannon was, of course, you know, heavily tied with Heavy Metal. But the cover of this thing says Darkstar, the spaced out spaceship, and it's got an upside down astronaut with toilet paper and a bottle floating in space, and it's made to look like it's really wacky, and this is not the way this movie is. It's not really portraying the movie the way it should be portrayed. So I was kind of disappointed in that. And then, as I mentioned on the comment board, I was also a bit disappointed in the edited version of this movie. I'm used to seeing director's cuts that are longer than what hit the theater. And when they pulled out a number of really good scenes in the director's cut, I was a bit upset. You know, I got to the end of the movie and said, wait a minute, where was the organ with all the bottles filled with you know, different amounts of liquid? That was really cool. Where was this scene? Where was all this cool stuff? And I was kind of disappointed in that edited down version. I felt a lot of what they had taken out really added to the movie for me. So, and that's about all I can really think of to say about Darkstar at the moment. So, talk to you later. Bye.
You know, you're right. It had a really unique charm to it, and all the dirty characters and the dingy characters and the dingy ship. Mm. And you know, it's just, there's wonderful and tangible kind of charm. Even the ship's computer, that voice, it's kind of, I can't decide whether it was like, over, you know, this breathy female computer voice. I can't decide if it was supposed to be, you know, motherly, or supposed to be sexy and sultry, or what. I couldn't, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think it veers towards sexy, doesn't it? I mean, just the way she sort of talks.
Yeah, I mean, I assume that's what she was going for. But there were times when she was kind of admonishing them and warning them to be careful.
Yeah.
I was kind of going like, well, this is, you know, motherly here. This isn't, you know, this is... But it was kind of, and actually I thought it was a nice touch that whenever the visual representation of the computer was kind of a bunch of text on a white square that looked like a skull. I thought that was
like the computer room itself was just a sort of classic sort of 60s, 70s sci-fi about computers, isn't it? With all the flashing lights and everything. I mean, even the sort of control room for the, like, you know, for the crew. It's like, even though it's small, it's like all these switches and everything all over the place, isn't it? You know, and you think they've got like this strange view of the future where everything's like, you know, you'd think now that everything would be like sort of touch screen and, you know, a voice activated, and these are all like flicking switches and recording into little cameras and everything, you know? So, I mean, it's very much of its time. I don't know. So, what are some of your favorite sequences? And I mean,
well, I do want to hit on what you just said. I really, and actually, the when in the beginning, I believe they've just dropped the bomb and on the planet. And you're right; they're flipping every switch imaginable. And I was kind of reminded of it. I thought about that, and I always remember the scene in the original Alien. Again, you know, Dan O'Bannon had his fingers on. But, you know, when Tom Skerritt goes basically to just check email, you know, I mean, of course, that film came out in 1979, but basically what's happening is Tom Skerritt is going to check email, and he flips like a sequence of like 200 switches, and you're just going, you know, these people must have thought that in the future, you know, to make a pot of coffee, you're going to have to flip 200 switches on five different panels, you know.
It's strange, because if you read sci-fi, some people seem to have got it right. But like a lot of the people just seem to sort of, I don't know, it's like, couldn't really think far enough ahead to sort of see that things might be sort of substantially different.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I know. I do know what you mean. It's like the classic example of cell phones. How almost no science fiction authors. I mean, I know that I believe people have said that Heinlein predicted it, but for the most part, people will have you in the future, you know, with no internet, just getting your information through faxes and waiting at phone booths.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I digress.
Yes. It's easy. But yeah, I mean, so I mean, going back to the question, I mean, did you really enjoy the film? Because I mean, I know it was the first time you've seen it, so.
Yeah, indeed, it was the first time I'd seen it, and while I did really like it, I think that's because I'm a strange person, and I recognize that all of us around here have quirky tastes in movies, and you know, I would have a hard time. Like, I wouldn't go into the office tomorrow and say, like, "Hey, everyone, you should go home and watch Dark Star," because everyone would come back and say, "What the hell did you recommend to us?" You know, because the special effects are atrocious. You know, when the ship is flying, I mean, it's laughable. I don't know if that's intentional or not.
It's like the way it sort of just stops dead in space.
Right.
You know, when you're sort of sitting next to the planets, and it's just, you're thinking, well, yeah, that's just a model stuck against the background, isn't it? You know, so.
Right. It was reminiscent of Super Friends, you know, cartoons from the same era. It was just so unbelievably ridiculous looking. And, but of course, I mean, that's the budget. And, And I'm able, you know, I don't have a problem forgiving a low budget film for looking horrible. But no, I really found it charming. I thought all of the characters, including the computer, and including the bombs, the obnoxious bombs, and
that's what got me was like that was sort of they actually needed the bomb to make it sort of a little bit different at the end. So you know, so when it did go wrong, it was more complicated than just sort of shooting the pins off, which Boyle I was trying to do with the laser. So that so I had this sort of intelligent bomb that I had to talk down. And you think, well, what sort of intelligence do you need to sort of hit a planet? You know, why did they have this sort of sophisticated, like, bomb to sort of hit, like, a dumb target?
Right,
and
that's
you just
true.
Think it was, like, part of the plot device was, so they could have the sort of sequence at the end where he's trying to talk it from exploding.
Finally, tip number 3 for your Dark Star viewing party. Consider a substitute title included in the Dark Star movie case. Suggestions include Ishtar or Southland Tales.
Hello, Deadpan. Just a Joe here with my log entry for Dark Star. So, Dark Star. Well, I'm going to have to express disappointment here, but not for the reasons one might expect. I wasn't bothered so much by the bad, cheesy effects. On the contrary, given when this was made and the budget that was involved, I'd say they did rather well. I wasn't bothered by the minimalist filmmaking either. In fact, the limited sets and sparse dialogue only helped to add to the feeling of being cooped up in space for 2 decades. No, what killed this film for me was just the plain bad storytelling. It's like they had this really great overall concept and then several really interesting ideas for scenes, but they failed to put it all together in a smooth, cohesive story. I mean, I swear they must have spent about 6 hours in that elevator shaft. At least, that's what it felt like. And in the end, I didn't care whether the guy lived or died. Really, I didn't care about any of the characters. The best thing I can say about this film is that it prompted me to buy this totally unrelated but oh-so-smooth Crosby, Stills, and Nash tune. So there you have it. This is Just a Joe. Out.
Let the memory of the evening be the first thing that you think of when you open up your smile and see me, Dark Star.
But you know, I still liked the concept, and I thought that was a good way to do AI, and in fact that I think has not been, you know, it was an interesting way of doing AI, which at that time had probably not been overdone as it has been now. But of course, HAL was brand new and fresh on everyone's minds. You know, when this came out.
So I mean, he was like, I mean, the computer goes wrong. I mean, I suppose that is a sort of classic trope of sci-fi, isn't it? Where the artificial intelligence goes wonky in some way,
right?
You know?
Well, they're not to be trusted.
Yes. Don't trust the silicons.
Right. Don't trust. Right. Our technology. We'll all be better off in caves. But no, I think it was. I'd say if I could, if someone, you know, if I knew someone had a quirky appreciation for movies, I would have to say the special effects are so bad you will kind of you'll kind of look around, you know, you'll be embarrassed to watch this. You'll be embarrassed to recommend it.
I mean, I just watched it on Sunday, and it really, I mean, some of the, it's really cringeworthy. Some of the acting's cringeworthy. I don't know whether that was deliberate as well, with like staring in the wrong, like staring into space and everything. Just the way they talk, like a flat monotone. It sort of that was a bit cringeworthy as well, you know.
Yeah, and it's, and actually, again, those long sequences with Dan O'Bannon. I mean, he's obviously not a trained actor. He's obviously a big nerd. I mean, you know, he was just a big nerd who loved this stuff, and he was having a blast doing it, and that's, you know, and you know, that's fine. I don't need John Gielgud.
Oh yeah.
You know, they should, if Sir John Gielgud had been in that role, it would have not been quite the same.
Well, but, no, I think I think you're right, but it sort of suited, didn't it really?
Hello, Deadpan. This is Amy Bowen, aka the Deadpan Ambassador. I wanted to give just a couple of last minute thoughts on Dark Star. As I said in my earlier voicemail, this was the first movie that was so bad I was laughing at it because of how bad and cheesy it was. I got it from Netflix, and they put the blurb on the outside of the DVD sleeve, and I only read half of it before I watched the movie. I read the second half after I watched the movie. It was in the second half that it was explained that it was a parody of 2001, A Space Odyssey. And so when I read that, I went, oh, that explains a lot. The fact that it was supposed to be a parody explains a lot of the crazy silliness. So, because I didn't know that, during the movie, I was kind of thinking, what on earth? Are these movie makers for real? Are they serious? So, yeah. I didn't know until the end. I guess that kind of qualifies this as a dumbass memory. And also, boy, not a whole heck of a lot happens in that movie. And the little beach ball alien, that was one of the things that really that made me laugh. That was funny and cute and cheesy, and I loved it. Anyway, so... Okay, Palooza movie, not one of my real favorites. Haven't listened to the first Palooza episode yet, but I will, I don't know when, pretty soon. Thanks, and yes, actually, I am one of the people who voted for it. Completely sight unseen, just because I thought it was time for more sci-fi. Okay, I guess that's all the thoughts I have on Dark Star. Deadpan is the way. Out.
But the other thing I would, my only other, and I'm going to let you have the floor, but my only other observation, and you actually, you can confirm, because I think this, I believe this was your experience and maybe used hairs as well. This seems like the type of movie that if you caught on your own, I mean, not like the way we do these paloozas, it's almost like a little bit of a study thing, but...
Yes.
But if you just caught this movie on your own, you would kind of watch it and go, what in the hell am I watching? But if you stuck it out and watched the whole thing, even when you were done, if you said, this is the stupidest thing I've ever watched, I think a few years later, you would kind of think back on it and think, yeah, that movie was hilarious. Like, there were there's so many great little moments. I think that, you know... Your initial reaction, probably, I don't know, that's just my theory. This is probably my experience would have been if I had found it just without this kind of guidance. I think I would have thought, this is completely ridiculous, like if I had caught it on cable years ago. But then, yeah, within a few years, I would have been thinking back, like, wait a minute, I really need to watch this movie again. I need to see, you know, I need to see, I need to see that the scenes where, you know, they're just beating on him because they're just tired of him because, you know, they're just annoyed to death with him. Or I need to see that. I think that's a great moment. Probably my favorite moment is the very final moment, seeing him, seeing him surfing. You know, he's getting his wish. I mean, those two guys, they got, you know, Pinback and Boiler got horrible deaths. But the other two guys got, you know, got beautiful deaths, the exact deaths that they would have chosen, I think.
Yeah, well, I don't know whether the book is that with the Phoenix asteroids that I don't think Talby sort of dies really. he gets sort of taken in. So, I mean, there's some sort of confusion. Like, you know, it could be that he didn't actually die because there's something funny about the Fiendless Asteroids. There's something sort of mystical about the Fiendless Asteroids that you get a little bit more of in the book. Not much, mind. But I don't know, can I have a quick talk about the book?
Absolutely. And that was by Alan Dean Foster, you guys said, right?
Yeah. I mean, it sticks to the film. He's sort of famous now for doing these novelizations. But you do get a little bit extra information. There's like, I think at the beginning, when Boyler says, I was making a sandwich. And did you notice that they were like, when they were eating later on, that it was all sort of liquids?
Right, right.
And so there's like a sort of scene where then Doolittle realizes, how on earth are you making a sandwich? And then you find out like a little subplot about Boyler, where he smuggled a load of food on board the ship. And
nice.
So you get like little bit like background information on them and everything. So it sort of fills out a bit. So it's not a bad novelization. I'm enjoying it. I haven't read it in years, but there's things like that. But it's still faithful to the film, but it adds a little bit. And also, I mean, you know, when Pinback, I mentioned this on the comment section, when Pinback goes into that room for the beach ball for the first time, and you see those lights, don't you?
Right,
In the background, and I think in the book they're called Luminants, and they're like sort of another sort of alien that they picked up. And so that's like, you know, because
well, he does kind of yell at them when he goes in. He says, you know,
yes,
get out of here.
Yeah. And like, so you get him, it's like, so you feel like they've been around a bit, and like, you know, they haven't discovered any sort of real intelligent life, and they're sort of cynical about that, which you get in the film as well, later on in the film as well, don't you, when they're talking about it, you know, and he says, like, who cares or something, doesn't he? Does he say, you know, yeah, do you think we're ever going to find intelligent life out there? And he says, like, who cares, you know, so.
Yeah, Doolittle, right, and it's interesting, you know, that you're kind of happy for Doolittle, but Doolittle has kind of become this, you know, I mean, in the very our first introduction to Doolittle, he just wants to go blow stuff up. I mean, that's...
Yeah. it's like after 20, you know, just so, you get the impression, like, oh, they've been sort of really enthusiastic at the beginning, and, like, 20 years has just sort of worn them down to the point where they just want to go home, and so they just want to find somewhere to blow up, don't they, you know?
Right, yeah, I guess, you know, it's kind of, I mean, believable is the last word I would apply to this movie, but, you know, but right, their behavior, and I guess, you know, that's a tribute to the good work that these guys did, and I'm going to touch on that really quickly. We're already at 20 minutes, you and I, here,
yeah.
but I don't want to make you late for work, but I will touch on really quickly that this movie did launch the career of, again, Dan O'Bannon, and whose name I said, and of course, the director, John Carpenter. I mean,
wow.
I mean, this is that's a big deal. I mean, this movie launched two guys who really helped to define a lot of the science fiction that we all grew up with in the 80s. You know, so I know these guys weren't at the forefront. I mean, that has to go to Lucas and Spielberg and I guess, I don't know, Crichton. I don't know, but I mean. And of course, the older guys, Heinlein and all. But I mean, for films, for science fiction film, these are, you'd have to say that no one outside of Lucas and Spielberg was more important to the fringe, especially to like the sort of B-level sci-fi, you know, stuff that the cult classic stuff. You know, Dan O'Bannon and John Carpenter. I mean, these guys were hugely important, and they both came from this film. And now, is it true that they're, or at least Carpenter is ashamed of this movie?
I honestly don't know. I thought he said it wasn't that Waiting for Godot. I don't know how to pronounce it. That's what he was saying about what he thought about the film was like Waiting for Godot set in space. You know.
Okay.
I don't know if I pronounced that right, mind. I've just probably shamed the entire British population there by pronouncing it wrong. I don't know. I mean. I think, me personally, for a first film, I mean, you see some terrible first films from as I become famous later on. It's really not a bad film, you know.
Yeah.
Considering like all the bad acting and everything, but I mean, it's like a sort of just like it's a fun sort of story. I mean, if you can sort of not try to analyze it too much, I think really, you know, it's a fun sort of film, isn't it? It's a fun film.
I'd agree. And, you know, it was really perfect. Absolutely perfect for a Deadpan Palooza. So I want to thank you and everyone else who voted for it and was into it. I mean, I wouldn't say this is the best movie we've ever watched, and certainly not the best movie I've ever seen. But I'm glad I've seen it. I enjoyed it for what it was. I had fun with it. And I hope, I know we have some other comments, and I hope we get lots of comments from people. And audio. I hope we get lots of audio from people. I already have some audio from people who've watched it. And you know what? We can tell the same story 4 years from now.
Very true.
Well,
I'm going to say I'm going to have to go, Jack. So,
it's
been an enjoyable conversation.
Yeah, well, thanks. It's been fun, Dan. And that's what I was going to say. I know you got to go. So, but thank you for your time. And
I'm glad you enjoyed it as well, because I was sort of had this vision of like everybody sort of hating it, you know, because of all its faults. But I'm glad some people enjoyed it.
Right. Well, it does have its faults, but yeah, I'm glad that people enjoyed it.
3, 2, 1.